Hello and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Elizabeth Lim, a member of the club's Art Forum and your program organizer for today. We're delighted to have renowned artist Gary Bukovnik as our speaker. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Gary Bukovnik. Gary Bukovnik has lived in San Francisco for more than a third of a century. Primarily using watercolor, monotype, and lithograph, Gary fuses sensual vitality and fluid yet powerful colorations, creating floral and culinary images. Renowned of his signature designs for the San Francisco Symphony, and every year since 1981, Gary Bukovnik has created an original work of art inspired by the music of San Francisco Symphony, which he has then donated to the symphony for its own benefit. If you haven't had a chance, the original artwork of the symphony posters that Gary has designed are on display at the San Francisco Symphony Lodge Lobby. Gary's solo exhibit includes museums such as Shanghai, Xiamen, Suzhou in China. Other exhibits also include countries in Japan, Slovenia, Netherlands, and others. There's upcoming events like in Bonfoy in Cleveland, Ohio, Tianjin Museum in September of this year, France Botanical Garden in October, in Youngstown, Ohio. So, Gary, you have the floor.
Well, thank you all for coming. I really, really appreciate it. So, Elizabeth has mentioned that there are some question cards that if you would like to ask questions, you can fill it out. Or, alternatively, I welcome interruptions, actually. So if anybody has a question about anything that I'm saying, just shout it out, and I'm happy to address it at that point. So I've lived in San Francisco since 1974, and originally I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, and from Cleveland I lived in Atlanta briefly. But it's in San Francisco that actually I owe my existence to this fabulous city. Like I said, I was born in Cleveland, Ohio. And my mother and father and I moved to live with my grandmother to Painesville, Ohio, which is about 35 miles to the east. Painesville is a center for nursery growing. And maybe some of you know about it, but there's a place called Wayside Gardens, and they would grow flowers, and they're shipped all over the United States. This was surrounding my grandmother's general store, where we lived, behind the general store. So the subject matter of flowers was always the most natural thing for me to paint and to draw. As a child, I guess one is not so discriminating. You just simply take what's at hand. And then, in addition to the subject matter, the medium of watercolor was one that was chosen by my mother because it wasn't messy. So I was able to do watercolors on the dining room table, and she could clean it up so that we could have dinner. So I've prepared now a little bit of a slide lecture about three techniques that I employ, plus also there's a section showing my studio, and then another section showing some recent exhibitions in China. So, again, if there's any questions, please, please interrupt me. I welcome it. Let's see if I can do this now here. There we are. There. So this is about traditional monoprint technique. Monoprint is similar to watercolor, which is my main medium, but it's similar to watercolor even though it employs oil color as the pigment, in so much as you have to think backwards about this. Unlike with general oil painting, where the thought process kind of occurs at the end of the brush and you work out all your problems on the canvas, with watercolor and with monoprint, you have to think about the end product and then dissect it in your mind and figure out how you're going to put it all together before you do it. Otherwise, it's a big mess and a mistake. So you can tell that I'm nervous. I'm sorry about that. So anyway, so with monoprint, I go to the print shop. This particular print shop was on South Park here in San Francisco. And what I would do is I would prepare a drawing that I was going to use as the subject for the print. And the drawing itself was on a piece of tracing paper, which I don't think you can see it beneath the plastic plate. And the outline of the image that I'm going to paint is on the plate there. And here the technician is rolling out a background, which will be a blend of blue colors that I had described to him what I wanted. So if this is a little bit too technical for you all, I mean, I apologize. Anyway, he's working out the blends. And there it is, looking very pretty. So, and then he applies the blend onto the plate. This monoprint technique uses an etching press, as opposed to the next technique, which uses a different kind of press. So here they are putting on the bottom part of the bottom color of the plate, which will make sense in a little while. And so then what the technician does is he removes, using rags or Q-tips or whatever is at hand, he removes the pigment that will be the background from the area into which I will paint. So here you see them doing that. Like that. So because when you do something like make monoprints, at least the way that I do it, and you hire a print shop for the day, you know, to execute my ideas, because it is just the way life goes, it's expensive, and it requires that I plan everything out kind of choreographed in a way. So all of these people, at the end of the day, they're exhausted. So I've described to them what I want done, and they're working on several pieces at once. So I'm just showing you one of them here. So you see they're preparing the plate for my entrance. Yes, that's correct. Yeah, they have to work with. Now this is oil color, so it's not quite as fast as watercolor. But nevertheless, when you employ an etching press, the pigment has to be very, very thin and very even. Otherwise, when the plate is rolled through the press with the paper, it kind of squashes out and you get a big Rorschach pattern. And we don't want that. So this is my hand there. And again, you can kind of see the lines on the paper, which are beneath the plate. So one of the reasons for doing monoprints is because of the speed with which it has to occur, and also that it is a different activity than what occurs in the studio. So that as watercolor informs how you make a monoprint, monoprints also inform the artist how to make a watercolor so that you stay fresh, or at least it helps stay fresh. I don't know if that makes any sense, but so. And anyway, here I am painting away. I don't do this technique anymore because the solvents are so lethal. And as I said, because of the cost of doing such a thing, I work very intensely, very hard, without break. At the end of the day, I was a crazy man, and I would have horrible nightmares that night, and just wild mood swings, because the solvents are so deadly. So, sad to say, I enjoyed doing it, but So here is the plate finished. And here they have put the plate onto the press bed of the etching press. And you can see here here's the paper on top there that they're going to roll through the press. The paper has been moistened and kept overnight in kind of a damp area. So it makes the characteristic that the paper has at this point is when it's put through the press, it's absorbent. And the color that's on the plate actually becomes part of the fiber of the paper. So, as opposed to the next technique, which I'll show you. Yes, I think so. Yeah. It's just because there's, you know, the lights in the studio are very bright, and so, and I'm really not a very good photographer. But that's what you're going to go home today. You're going to say, boy, that guy, he's not a good photographer at all. Anyway, so here we are, and they're running it through the press. And there is the finished print with me, much younger than I am now. So, actually, you can only do one. With the way that I do this, you can only do one. If I had used different solvents, there is a possibility of having a ghost print. So you could get one print and a ghost print. So, see, this is what's left on the plate. It's almost entirely gone. So now, back into my studio, and I'll show you a less traditional way of making monoprints. This technique employs an offset lithographic press. So here, now, this is in, actually, it's the same print shop, but they have moved, and now they're in Brisbane, just south of San Francisco. So here's the technician mixing up the palette that I'll use during the course of the day. Now, prior to arrival at the print shop, I will already have made, in my studio, I will have made backgrounds for the print. At least I make the plate for the backgrounds for these prints, which are then lithographed by the print shop, and they're all ready and prepared for my arrival on the day that we're going to do this. So anyway, he's mixing the palette. And if you notice, there was I should have shown you. There's a lot of white that he has there. And this technique uses no solvents at all. Instead, it uses a very loose kind of white pigment, and all the colors are mixed with white, whereas in the technique I just showed you before, everything is very crystal clear and sparkling. This is rather thick and pasty looking. That isn't how the end product comes out, but you'll see. This is monotype. Oil-based paint. Monotype originated, I'm pretty sure, Rembrandt made monoprints, but at that point he was taking small copper plates in which he would engrave an image, whether it was a landscape or whatever, and each time he would print that plate, it would be inked in a different way, so that if it was a landscape with atmospheric inking, you could make it appear that there was a storm brewing, or it was dawn, or it was night. So each of these, this is how monoprint began. Then in the 19th century, it became kind of a party game for artists who get together, and they would sit with a plain plate, without any engraving on it, and they would sit and talk and drink or play. I mean, you have things that go on that we're not supposed to know about. And they would make these images on copper plates. At the end of the evening, they would run them through the press. Degas was a great proponent of doing this, as well as our own Maurice Prendergast was very, very good at this. But the artists would get together and kind of have a fun time. So anyway, here's the press, which is the size of this room. And you can see Here is the plate. Preprinted backgrounds for the image. So what will happen is, as I paint the plate, it will be laid down on the press bed, and that huge roller will roll over it and dissect my painting, subdividing the ink on several sheets of paper. So with this technique, maybe four or five images that are all unique also. They're not the same. Yes, this is a zinc plate. Whereas the other technique uses a plastic plate. Onto the zinc plate is bonded a sheet of plastic to keep the surface kind of slippery. So here it is. Here's the plate laid out for me to paint on. So this is the progression of, let's see how it all looks. There. And there, it's almost done. So, and here I am kind of tidying up the painting and making any final additions. You can see I've gotten older. This is what the solvents do to you. So there's the finished plate. Now the plate will be laid onto the press bed there. And you can see, here's the sheets of paper that they're going to subdivide my painting onto. So there's the technician. He's proceeding. Interestingly, on the day that we do this kind of printing, when they finally pull the prints, they never look very brilliant to me. They always look really dull and not so interesting, and I go home a little dejected. And fortunately, the next day I go back and they all look great. I guess an artist has to be a fan of his own work. I mean, so here they are, subdividing the inks. And there's the plate after they pulled all the ink off of it. So not much left. So there is one of the finished prints. Here are some images of completed monoprints done in this technique. This affords the artist an opportunity to make what I think are just about the largest monoprints you can make. They're 50 some inches tall by 40 some inches wide.
And that's limited by the press.
Yes, that's exactly right. I believe that Experimental Editions here in San Francisco was able to find a technique by which Sam Francis could make some very large prints, but and he was using a plywood plate, but I really don't know any more than that. So now I'll show you watercolor. Sure, I'd love to. Well, I'm old now and I value what years I have left. So I don't want to shorten my life any more than it's already been shortened. Excuse me. So here you are in my studio, and this is how I make a watercolor. So first I go to the flower market, and I get a subject matter. The subject matter that chose the artist, not the artist who chooses the subject matter. And so there it is. You see, I work on a big drawing board. There. So if there are any geometric elements in watercolor, what I generally do is lay them out onto tissue paper and then transfer them onto the watercolor paper so that there will be no erasures and no extraneous lines. The reason for that is when you disturb the surface of the paper, the watercolor occasionally won't absorb into the paper correctly, and you'll be able to see it later on. And I want the end product to have the appearance of simplicity, brilliance, and the more it can look like there's no art involved in making it, the more successful I think I've been. When I have exhibitions, occasionally I'll hear someone say, not to me, but looking at, well, I could do that, you know, and I think, well, that's it. Then I know I've succeeded, because instead of focusing, sometimes you see a painting and you think, boy, is that painting difficult. Well, when you do that, then you're seeing more the trouble the artist has with the technique as opposed to the execution of what idea they have, you know, and what it is that they have to say. I could be wrong about all of this, you know. Anyway, so here I am laying out the vase on a sheet of paper. This, I apologize, it's so light, but I draw very, very lightly on the paper, again, so as to have a completely clean surface. I always tell people that you can kind of see the drawing there. There were some portrait drawings of Aang that I had seen both as a student and over the years. And Aang never, there was never a question in his mind when he would lay a line down onto a drawing about should the line be to the right or should it be to the left. No, it should be exactly where it is. And there were no erasures. So, again, this activity is exciting to me, you know, that I can think out an image in my mind, and then just with a very sharp pencil and a single line, without any kind of guessing around, you just start drawing. And then that's it. So here I am painting. I always paint green first. Part of it is because green is something that's common to all plants, or not all plants, but many, many plants. And when you paint the green part, then you already have, you can see the composition pretty clearly and see if something has to change before I move on to the remaining painting. My pigments are divided into two palettes. You can see this one is a warm palette, kind of peeking in the corner there. And the other one is a cool palette. So this is how to paint tulips, at least my way. There. So one of the things that I don't do so much anymore, but I used to do, is that I would paint in the center of a sheet of paper, and then I would decide later where the outside edges of the painting would be. I guess that's kind of cheating, isn't it? Well, because we'd like you to believe that. Exactly. So here, putting some marks on the tulip petals. And again, you can see the way, the general way that I paint is that there's one application of color, and then that's it. Sometimes I think about going back and making another overlay of color or adding some more delineation. And usually I wait overnight before I do such a thing, and the next morning, of course, I don't do it.
So. Same brush?
No, this is almost always the same brush. I use a number 8 watercolor brush for art paintings, no matter how big they are. So there's the almost completed watercolor. And there it is. So here are some paintings in my studio. I used to have a Miata, and there was a point at which I felt that my art perhaps wasn't reflecting my life. And there were so many things happening here in San Francisco that were tragedies or perhaps brilliant occurrences. And I thought, well, how are flowers saying anything about what it is that I'm experiencing, you know. So one of the things I did was I painted my car. And there were two paintings of my car. One is with the car filled with flowers, and the other one is using my car as a section of a still life. More about that. Oh, let's see here. There. So these are eucalyptus. All of these paintings are pretty big. I think this is almost 8 feet tall and about that big. So maybe about 36 inches. Here, this is our magnolias. Actually, the finished painting doesn't have that black line through the middle. That's simply because of, at the time, digital photography was not available, and so this was done on transparencies and pieced together. But this painting is 7 by 10 feet.
So did you roll watercolor rolls?
No, actually, I use these large sheets of watercolor paper, which are 60 inches by 41.5 inches. The reason for that is it's a heavier weight than the watercolor paper on the rolls. You know, when one takes and changes the scale of a subject matter, it forces both the artist and the viewer to see something in a slightly different way, which is also one of the reasons why my paintings include a lot of white space. It isn't because I am lazy and just don't want to paint it. It's because it's the isolating of form and shape and color, and it makes, I don't know, it gives you a small bit of information about me, I guess, and about my life. Since that's actually, isn't it really what an artist paints, is pictures of himself or pictures about his experience. Like I said, I felt that my paintings were not reflective of experience of things that I was experiencing, when in point of fact, they were all along. The paintings have been just pictures of me. Like so much art, you know, it's subjective what we like and what we don't like. I happen to like my pictures. Well, I told you, I'm my own biggest fan. And but, you know, when one paints a subject matter like flowers, which is something already beautiful, there seems to be less art in it, you know? Or it's the impression that the artist is not participating in the final painting or the final image as much as when you paint something. Well, there are many great painters. I think of Anselm Kiefer, who is somebody I admire enormously. I mean, he paints subjects of great gravity and pain. It's not me. I'm a happy guy, you know? And for better or worse, these actually are me, you know? And it's also, maybe this is one of the reasons I love it here so much in San Francisco. We have such, not today particularly, but we have beautiful light. And this is intrinsically one of the most beautiful places in the world. So it just fit for me. When I first saw San Francisco, there was no question in my mind that this is where I wanted to be. Let's see here. There. This is a tree on Dolores Park, which now lives in the Museum of Modern Art in Slovenia. My last name is Slovenian, which is... could explain that. And here's a somewhat recent painting. This also being pretty recent. The subject matter flying around, and it has offered me an opportunity to perhaps make my paintings about something a little bit more than they were before. Before, they were all still life and very calm, and then I had, I'll tell you about it. I felt that, well, change is one of the things I think that an artist values most. And change is also something that you can't force. If you force it, then your paintings or whatever it is will smack of something that isn't the truth, you know? And so I was always reluctant to artificially just or arbitrarily start doing something different. So I kept doing what I'd always been doing until I went to Rome, and I was staying at the American Academy in Rome. Being a watercolorist and liking everything within my control, I shipped every single thing from my studio to Rome to be in my studio in Rome. It took 3 days to get from my studio to San Francisco Airport to get to Rome Airport, and it took a month to get from Rome Airport to my studio, which was, maybe 10 minutes away. During that time, I became pretty upset because here I was in my beautiful studio in Rome with marvelous working table and being in this great city and nothing to do. After a while, I had taken all the walks I could take and visited all the museums I wanted to visit, and I wanted to work. So I started, I went to an art supply store, and I bought kind of minimal supplies and bought some flowers and brought them back to the studio, and I threw them on the table, and I painted them. I didn't think too much about it. It was just something to do until my things arrived. And then finally, my things arrived. I put all those paintings that I had done in this fashion away and went to work. When I returned to San Francisco, I was looking at all of the paintings that I had made. The only paintings that exhibited change were those paintings that I had done without my materials, when I had been forced to just do something different, even though it wasn't motivated by anything other than necessity. And I thought, this is really a big gift that I've been given. So I tried to amplify this idea of things flying around and things kind of exploding and coming apart. And this is when I realized these really do represent me. I mean, like I told you, I'm a fortunate person, I'm a happy person, and this is how I feel most of the time. How lucky can you get to have been privileged to make a living, from your art in this great city? Let's see here. I talk too much and then the computer forgets. So here we have, excuse me, these are orchids. And here, the paintings now, even though they are still flowers, become even more compositions of color and shape. And I mean, you can identify everything in them. I'm not good enough to be abstract. So you can see that the paintings are all multiples of that 40 by 60 inch sheet. So this is two sheets of paper. There.
And there's the vase and
stuff. Yes, yeah. Yes, well, they're flying through the air, kind of like me. And occasionally I still put vases in the paintings, but they don't just sit there anymore. Now the vases are tipping over and water is pouring out, and it seems to be a little bit more. So now we're back in the studio. So this next part I put into my talks just because frequently people ask what the studio looks like, and there aren't too many pictures. I live south of Market on Howard Street between 7th and 8th, and on the second floor of a little warehouse building. And I've been there since 1976, actually. So this, I didn't paint this. This is a painting by a man named Nicholas Bristow, and it hangs in the Cleveland Museum of Art. And as a child, this was my favorite painting in the museum. And it's a painting of Morpheus. And I had a copy made so that I can see it. So this is the steps into my studio. And this is the back wall of the studio. Music plays a very important part in my life. and you'll see that I have a lot of speakers all over the place there. I like classical music, actually. I like the San Francisco Symphony recording. And I can make my studio sound like Davies Symphony Hall. Almost. Not as good. It's not quite live. So this is my work table with one of my two cats. This is Ava, who's posing for you there. And this is the hallway that leads into the studio and some of my art collection. And this is the living part of the studio, which is actually the smallest part. So, kind of colorful. There. And here are some of my CDs. So, oh, the bust is of the Emperor Lucius Verus. And he comes from the Louvre. And you'll see that there's a lot of plaster casts there. The just beyond him, there are three graces that I don't know who they're by. Then there's the Dying Gaul, which is in the Capitoline Museum in Rome. Beyond that is another statue from the Louvre. I think Marcus somebody or another. Not Marcus Aurelius, but... And the reason for that is I saw a painting many years ago of the studio of Edwin Church. And there were all these plaster casts in his studio, and I thought, oh, I like that idea. So then I began to collect them. So now I have a lot of plaster casts from various places that I've traveled and that I bring home. I've never painted pictures of them, but artists used to do that. This is the living room also. I mean, it's a pretty fabulous existence for me, I think. Really. Yeah. Thank you. Oh, yes. Well, usually it's by friends, you know, that have either given it to me or that I have bought. So now the next thing here, and the last part of the slide lecture, is about China. This has been the most recent focus of my exhibitions. And here I am standing in front of a big wall, as you can see. I did not tell them to say that I was famous American watercolorist. This was their idea. This is at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Shanghai. So I've been, this was the very, I guess the second exhibit I had in China. So, and here I am with the young man who is responsible for all of the exhibitions I've had in China. And he's here today with us, right there. Yeah. So Yang had seen my work on the computer and contacted me, and over a period of time kept trying to convince me to that I should show my works in China. And I said that I tried to do this before. I paid people, I begged people, but nobody's been able to do it. And he said, well, I can do it. So he did. And this has been ongoing now for over 2 years that he's been doing this. And this year we will have an exhibition at the Tianjin Art Museum. There he is taking pictures in the gallery here. So we'll kind of go through this quickly. But it does give the idea of what the museum looks like. This has been a wonderful experience for me. In China, this is the opening reception for that exhibition. There's me, not that much younger than I am now. There. This is the representative from the American Embassy. So. Also, there were several... I've exhibited many times in Japan, and... the Japanese brought four tours of people from Kyoto over to see the exhibition during the course of its run, which was particularly gratifying to me. So here are some of the people from Japan there. Just like we're doing here, I gave a talk in Shanghai one day and a demonstration, which is another thing that I do for people. explaining how you can make your own watercolor. So the difference in this that particular lecture was that some of the children were like 3 years old, and I've never have confronted such young children before, and they were pretty active. So this is in front of the art museum in Suzhou, where the exhibition went next. The reason for this picture is here is a big screen on the side of the museum, and there's me. I thought that was something. Anyway, so again, we have more openings, which are considerably more formal in China than they are here. Oh, it's been fabulous. A lot. Yeah, many people are interested in finding out what it's like to, you know, make a living as an artist in the United States and talking about different points of view. I'm generally not political, so we don't talk about anything like that just because I really don't have an interest in it. It's not because I'm hiding it. The director of the museum in Shanghai asked me prior to the opening what my political beliefs were, and I said, well, I think everybody should get along, and he said, good. So I don't know how much you've heard about artists getting into difficulty in China because they get involved in things that are big. Yes, yeah. Luckily, that's a difference. Also, even though these are museum exhibitions, the museum, after the exhibition is over, offers anybody an opportunity to come to find me and to purchase something from the show. Anyway, that's the end of the visual presentation. So I know that Elizabeth had some questions.
Thank you, our listening audience, that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to artist Gary Bukovnik. And now, Gary, we have some questions. Anybody has any questions for Gary?
Yes.
Hello. I just want to say it's such a pleasure to see you, and I have appreciated so much the prints and the San Francisco Symphony Lodge. And I just want you to know that, you know, just viewing other people watching your prints, the number of smiles that you have created, it's really, really quite special. How did you come to, you said you love classical music, but how did you come to want to donate that beautiful art to the symphony?
Well, as I've been saying, I'm really, really very fortunate. You know, here I am, this little guy from Painesville, Ohio, and through various steps I moved to San Francisco, and everybody telling me, well, you know, you can't be an artist there. There's so many artists in California already, it's not going to work out for you. And I thought, well, if that was the case, I would be willing to give that up to live here. I mean, so I really like it here. I get you gather. And but one thing leads to another, and I thought I'm neither the smartest nor the dumbest. So somewhere in the middle. And if other people can find their way with art through life, why can't I? So when I got here, I didn't have a job, and so I was just painting pictures in my apartment. Also, like I mentioned, flowers are intrinsically beautiful, so it tends to denigrate, you know, the art, especially when you're, how old was I, 24 years old? I think 23 years old when I moved here. No, I guess I was, yeah, something like that. Anyway, I was painting little landscapes, which to me at the time felt like it was a more meaningful subject and a more meaningful activity than painting flowers. I, through the kindness of friends, one friend knows another friend, and another friend, and this last one had a gallery. in Civic Center. It was called ADI Gallery. And the man who owned the gallery, his name was Stephen Foster, who had a certain gift for helping people. He helped me, and he took my work, and he sold my work, and all these little landscapes. And one day called me up on the phone and said, "Gary, I have something serious to discuss with you. Would you please come down to the gallery?" And I thought, oh, no, I'm going to be thrown out of the gallery. I mean, and I showed up, and he said, no, nothing like that. It's just, when I look at your painting, somehow I think you should be painting flowers. And I thought, oh, my goodness, it shows. My dirty little secret of being a flower painter, it shows. And, of course, that wasn't true. What it was is that he probably had a client who wanted a painting of flowers, and I'm a very agreeable person, and he knew that I would do it, so I did it. Well, over time, as I'm painting the flower pictures for him, I began to realize that what I was perceiving as the bad news was actually the good news. You know, people, especially in the 19th century, we hear the idea that artists are searching for themselves, trying to find yourself. Well, all along I had myself, you know, and here I was running away from it. I thought, well, I'm going to embrace it. So I, you know, like I said, art is subjective. Some people like this painting, some people don't like that painting. That's the way the world goes, and that's actually a good thing, because it means if everybody likes everything, then there's nothing there. There is no substance. There is no message. It sounds too grand to say message. So I began to have a life in art in San Francisco, and I was being appreciated. One of the things I thought I could do, I don't have any money, and what can I do to pay back, you know, to give back? So as it turns out, one of the things I can do is I can give to the San Francisco Symphony. It combines my two loves, art and music. And the symphony initially asked me to do something for the St. Matthew Passion was the first one Ado DeVart was conducting, and this was in, I believe, 1981. The next year, the woman who was in charge of development at the symphony asked me to make an image for a season poster. And I said, well, that's very nice of you to ask, but don't you want to ask somebody else? No, I want to ask you to do this. So I did it. The next year, she asked again. I said, really, don't you want to give another artist a chance? She said, no, I have something in mind. And what she had in mind was making a succession of images by the same person. And as it turns out, this will be my 32nd year of doing something for the San Francisco Symphony upcoming, and it's the longest running relationship between a visual artist and a musical organization anywhere in the world. I was stunned by this. So, you know, so how lucky can I get? Thank you. Yes.
I would like to say, on behalf of the San Francisco Symphony, how very fortunate we are, Gary, that you have indeed been a part of our, such an integral part of our family, and how very much we appreciate the moniker that you have given us. And clearly, this has been so important to us. We are extremely proud to have, of course, had your wonderful exhibition this past year in the Loge area, and, of course, your magnificent book as well. It is truly an honor and a privilege to have had you all of these years, and we look forward to a very lifelong relationship forever.
Thank you. Well, it's very kind of you to say that, but the truth is the privilege is all mine. Yes.
What's the most expensive piece that you've sold, and did you ever imagine it would sell for that amount?
Well, let's see. What's the most expensive piece? I think there was a painting in excess of $30,000. So for a watercolor, this is significant, you know. And I think it's nothing less than a miracle, if you ask me. Pardon me. But I mean, it's one more example of how lucky can I get. I mean, I don't mean to sound like Pollyanna here, you know, but how many of you know artists who have had no recognition who deserve it? You know, people who have worked hard their whole lives and are ignored. I have what I have as far as talent. It's just neither more nor less than what it is. But I've been really, really fortunate, you know, that I'm allowed to do these things here in San Francisco and that, well, or around the world. Like I said, this little guy from Painesville, Ohio, I was walking down the street in Beijing just about a month ago, and I thought, in my wildest dreams, this never would have occurred to me, you know, that I would grow up and be an artist and I would be exhibiting pretty much all over the world. I mean, I've had exhibitions in New Zealand, Australia, several places in Europe, of course, across this country, Japan, China, Taiwan. I mean, it's really, this is amazing, amazing.
Any more questions?
Yes. You were going to ask a question about technique, about wet on wet.
I was going to ask if you ever painted wet on wet.
Almost never. The reason for that is it's less control. So I like everything to be under control. And I mean, it's kind of a good thing in watercolor and maybe a bad characteristic in life to be like that. But so I've tried to hang loose as far as everything else goes. But it's always wet on dry.
So I'm fascinated by your comment about worrying that flowers, painting flowers, is not it's not significant.
Well, it's not art, is how it's frequently seen.
So can you talk a little bit more about that? Because you sort of seem to have changed your mind. And
well, I think why change my mind for me? Because it's what I want to do. I mean, the subject matter has been such a big part of my life, all my life, that it is the language through which I speak, you know, both the flowers and the watercolor. But there are other subjects that are also a little more taboo. I mean, if you want to paint puppies or people who like to paint children, I mean, all of these can be seen as less than high art. You know, I mentioned Anselm Kiefer, who is a very, very great artist. Not everybody can be that, you know. The world is made of a lot of different people who have a lot of different thoughts. So it's, anyway, like that. So I think it's just, like I said, I got over it. And I'm an unashamed flower painter.
Unfortunately, we have reached to the point in our program where there is only time for one more last question.
Right now, I just tell everybody, as class, Gary also working in China. We finish five exhibitions in China already. Each gallery and a museum and somebody come to see his painting. We like his painting very much. Even he isn't in the gallery too. He's a very nice man in China. Everybody can feel about that. That's all.
Well, you know, as an artist, another thing to feel fortunate about is that in art is a language without boundaries. Everybody understand? Now you see what a fool I am. This is the other thing, as an artist, and you force yourself to become more sensitive visually. This sensitivity is not compartmentalized. You become, I cry at concerts, I cry at parades. So at the thought of everybody getting along.
Our thanks to Gary Bukovnik for his insightful and delightful comments here today. Thank you to Ann Smith, our program chair, volunteers Janice and Walt. We also thank our audience here as well as listening to the recording. And now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 108th year of enlightenment discussion is adjourned.